Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Welcome to the show. Today we've got Rajat Soni on. Rajat is one of the best Twitter accounts to follow, in my opinion. He's got a great YouTube channel, and we talk about MicroStrategy's playbook. We talk about hyper Bitcoinization. We talk about Bitcoin demonetizing things like real estate. So it was an incredible discussion we had. I really think you're going to enjoy it. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Rajat here. Rajat, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, I'm excited. I was telling you offline that I think you probably have one of the best Twitter accounts out there when it comes to Bitcoin. It's like every day there's just new gems that you're producing. So I'm looking forward to this. I want to start with something that I think is kind of fun. So last week you tweeted this out. I'm going to pull this up here. You said, if you have $100,000 income, make sure you accumulate at least 0.1 Bitcoin, cut your expenses. I think 0.1 Bitcoin will make you work optional within 30 years. If you want to retire earlier, 0.25 probably work optional in 20 years, and one Bitcoin will make you work optional within 10 years, in my opinion. So what I'm curious is, so the Bitcoin Way, we're cautious on price predictions. We think it's sort of a fool's errand to try timing when things are going to happen, but I understand the trajectory that you're observing here. So I'm curious, what sort of general assumptions were you making? How could you maybe expand on this thought a little bit? I think people will find this interesting.
Oh yeah, of course. So the number one, I mean, your audience probably knows this already. The supply is finite. There's never going to be more than 21 million. So if you own one Bitcoin, and let's say over the next 10 years, all these institutions find out, I think Michael Saylor came out with this prediction that the next 10 years is going to be the gold rush for Bitcoin, or the Bitcoin rush, I guess. And over the next 10 years, we're going to see a lot of institutional investors come in. We're going to see a lot of new retail investors come in. We're going to see Bitcoin just get easier and easier to access for more and more people all around the world. So what I think is, over the next 10 years, I would be surprised if Bitcoin is below $1 million. I mean, I could be completely wrong on this. Obviously, none of the stuff that I say would be considered financial advice. I always say I could be wrong. My predictions could be completely off. Let's say I'm just too bullish and it takes 20 years instead of 10 years, or 30 years instead of 10 years. You'd still be better off compared to investing in the stock market, because with the stock market, it'll take you 40, 50 years to get to that point where you can finally feel like you're financially free, work optional. I do think that my estimates were a little conservative there with the one Bitcoin, with the 0.25 Bitcoin and the 0.1 Bitcoin. I actually think 0.01 Bitcoin will probably get you pretty far within the next 30 years, because 30 years is a very long time. I know even with the power law, people always talk about that. People always quote that. It's pretty conservative. But even with the power law, I mean, I don't know what the price would be in 30 years, but I think it would probably be at least a few million. Maybe you wouldn't be financially free with 0.01, but you'd have a nice amount of savings in real terms that you can use to maybe even start a business, to acquire a business that maybe is doing very well. Or you can use that 0.01 Bitcoin to pay off your mortgage, or you can do something to help yourself financially. Maybe it won't get you fully financially free. I mean, in the tweet, I did mention 0.1, but even if you have 0.01, any amount of Bitcoin is going to add up to a lot of value over time. And if you can accumulate it, you're just putting yourself ahead of the crowd, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and how do you distinguish? So I think a lot of people, and hopefully more people listening to this show, understand the difference. But, you know, when you think about like a Bitcoin proxy, like an ETF, because a lot of people, I own Bitcoin in a retirement account, and what they own is the ETF. So you get access to the price action, but nothing else. I'm curious, do you view that as a viable option, sort of, you know, an augmentation to holding Bitcoin in self-custody, or you know, what's sort of your general feeling around that?
So the ETF, you're saying?
Yeah. So if someone said, oh, I need to own 0.1 Bitcoin, or I need to accumulate one Bitcoin, and they go buy the ETF, Okay, so that changes the way that you view this, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's the same thing, because with the ETFs, you could get, I mean, let's say, for example, the US government or even the, I'm in Canada, so let's say the Canadian government, they charge you an unrealized capital gains tax and they chop 75% off the top of your Bitcoin. I mean, that completely changes things. With the ETF, I mean, of course, with self-custody Bitcoin, I'm not saying to not pay the taxes. I'm not saying to go against the law. I'm not saying to go to prison for the rest of your life. But I'm saying it's much easier for you to get around it. I think it's much harder for governments to implement these rules when they're just completely ridiculous if you have self-custody. But if you have it in an ETF, for example, I used to work at a brokerage where it was a stock brokerage. So I'd constantly see people's accounts blocked off because of CRA regulations, because they haven't paid their taxes, because they have alimony payments, because there's something going on where their entire account is blocked. They can't access it until they talk to the CRA, and the CRA then reaches out to the brokerage and just takes off that block or that freeze, whatever it is. But I mean, it's that easy, right? So let's say you have $10 million in Bitcoin and you owe $50,000 in taxes. Who's to say that the CRA or the IRS is not going to block your accounts and stop you from being able to access everything just because you need to pay them? And who's to say that that's not going to happen? Who's to say that your government can't confiscate your Bitcoin over the next 30, 40, 50 years? Who's to say that something along the lines where, let's say, your custodian messes up, maybe Coinbase messes up, maybe BlackRock messes up somehow? Nobody can say that that's not going to happen. But if you have Bitcoin in self-custody, you can rely on yourself. You have more choices that you can make. So you can take self-custody, you can diversify, you can have, let's say, multi-sig, you can have all these different kinds of storage methods used that make sure that nobody can take your Bitcoin from you without your permission. And I had a conversation with Joe Carlisari. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he's a Bitcoin lawyer. And he was saying that the rules, the regulations around Bitcoin are going to change over time. We're going to see different regulations come out that either make it easier for you to take self-custody, but possession based on the law is based, it's very difficult to describe possession of Bitcoin based on the current regulations, because who owns the private key? If you have multiple copies of a private key, who owns that Bitcoin? Let's say me and you both own a private key. Who owns that Bitcoin? Do you own it or do I? The ownership is just whoever can move the Bitcoin. Whoever gets to it first is the one who owns it. So let's say I'm in court and you own the same private key as me, and you figure out that I'm in court and my Bitcoin is being taken from me by the law, and you think this Bitcoin is going to be gone anyways. It's going to be taken from him anyway. So I might as well just take it instead of the government taking it. So now I don't possess that Bitcoin anymore. Now the Bitcoin's moved to a different wallet and I had nothing to do with that transaction. So I think it's very difficult to prove that somebody owns Bitcoin with self-custody, but in the ETFs, it's very easy to prove it. It's very easy to governments for governments to take your Bitcoin. So no, it's definitely not the same thing. When you own Bitcoin in ETFs, you're not getting all the benefits of owning Bitcoin in cold storage. And
yeah,
that just makes it a completely separate asset.
That's a very interesting example, like the court example. And also, I mean, I guess I think most people are waking up to this. I understand that people do have retirement accounts. Maybe they have situations where just owning Bitcoin outright in self-custody isn't possible for, you know, the entirety of their portfolio. But I think you just hit on a really, really important example of the freedom optionality that you get with self-custody Bitcoin. So that's fantastic. Okay, let's take a step. I wanted to jump into that one because I thought it was a fun tweet that you shared recently. I think a lot of people are, you know, I know like Simply Bitcoin does the how much do you need to retire or whatever occasionally. So you have a more traditional financial background. You're a CFA. What exactly was it that led you into Bitcoin in the first place?
I think it was multiple things. So there was actually so somebody posted about the Bitcoin Standard and I got really curious. I think this was around the hype for the last cycle, and somebody posted about the Bitcoin Standard and I started reading it, and I started listening to Michael Saylor podcasts. But in the beginning, I mean, I thought it was a scam like everybody else. I was in shit coins. I was in just all kinds of random crap that has no value. I wasted a lot of money and a lot of time on other things until I actually came to my conclusion. But what made it really difficult for me was, number one, the cash flow. There's no cash flow. So I had to wrap my head around capital gains are more important than cash flow. If you can earn 50% capital gains, why do you need 4% cash flow? It doesn't really make any sense. You create your own cash flow with Bitcoin. That's how I see it. You can either borrow against your Bitcoin, or you can maybe sell some of your Bitcoin to create cash flow. That's how I see Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a savings vehicle. So if you need cash, sell a little bit of your Bitcoin and use that cash that you get to pay for your expenses, whatever your expenses are. So to me, that part was really difficult. I got over it by really doing the research to understand what Bitcoin is. But I think what got me into really wanting to accumulate Bitcoin for my overall portfolio was understanding that, I don't know, this is kind of a controversial take, but real estate investing is basically exploitation. What people are doing is they're buying as many properties as they possibly can, and then they're holding onto them until they can find a renter who's willing to pay whatever astronomical price they want to receive for their property for that monthly payment. And I think a lot of the problem stems from governments just bailing out real estate investors whenever they do make stupid mistakes. Let's say when the price of real estate comes down and rental prices are about to come down, governments will step in, they'll bail out real estate investors. The Federal Reserve will start lowering interest rates to make sure that the property values don't drop too much. But I think the entire system is essentially designed to keep this landlord, essentially slave relationship going as long as possible. And I think real estate is basically the stem for that. And I used to be one of those people who really wanted to own real estate rental properties, just rental properties, and to make cash flow, passive income through that. But then once I kind of studied this side of things, and I realized that the entire real estate market is a Ponzi scheme, essentially. It's based on just fake money. It's based on the base is built on a very, it's not built on a very stable foundation. Because as soon as people start losing their jobs, how are they going to pay for rent? And then as soon as people can't pay for their rent, how are landlords going to pay their mortgage payments? And then as soon as landlords can't make their mortgage payments, banks can't service their debts, and they get into problems. And now they have this possession of so many houses that maybe they don't want because they lent money to someone who wanted to buy a bunch of real estate. It's just a whole cycle, right? So that's kind of what pushed me into Bitcoin. That's kind of what got me to start thinking differently about Bitcoin. I used to also think that stocks are great. But then again, a deep dive shows you that they're not really that great because, again, you have to rely on a custodian. The custodian can just lose your stocks. I mean, I know it's probably not going to happen, but it's possible, right? There's also the fact that you have to rely on an exchange. This exchange can block your accounts. Again, governments can come in and they can freeze your accounts. They can do all that stuff. So with Bitcoin, none of that's possible. And once you see that, once I saw that, I started doing a deeper dive. And I think mempool really helped to solidify it for me because I could actually see what's happening with Bitcoin. I could see the blocks being created. I could see the Coinbase transactions. I could see every single transaction that ever happened. And then on top of that, you can also see the inscription in the very first block, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. Once you see that, and then you see the reasoning for why this thing was created in the first place, it starts making sense. The loop is basically completed. The connection is made where you start realizing that the old system is trash and this system, this Bitcoin thing, is probably going to replace it completely I wouldn't be surprised if it happens within the next decade, but it could happen in a longer time. But the earlier you are, of course, the more Bitcoin you can accumulate, the faster you get to it, the easier it is to buy as much Bitcoin as possible. So the beginning for me was NGU, number goes up technology, and then over time it was kind of a revolution.
So everything you said about real estate, stock market is, I think, almost inarguably true. But most people in traditional finance don't understand that, haven't seen that, they haven't seen the light yet. What do you think it was about either your personality specifically or your curiosity that enabled you to reach those conclusions? Because I just think about like the people I know who work in traditional finance. First of all, they don't even ask me about Bitcoin, so I don't have a lot of opportunities to share. But if I tried to articulate that, I think they're so accustomed to this is just the way the world is and the way the world works that it would be like I was speaking a foreign language. What do you think it was about you that enabled you to see that?
I think the first thing was the reading the Bitcoin Standard, because the way that things are worded in that book, I think that was such a great book. I feel like Saifedean did such a great job on there. The way that he worded things was it kind of just made me rethink my positions. And I didn't know a lot of the things that were in that book. I didn't know the history of money, for example. I did my CFA, and in the CFA, you don't learn anything about the history of money. You just make the assumption that the US dollar will be around forever. And I think that's what really got me, just the new knowledge that the dollar hasn't been around forever. I mean, I knew that already, but who even really thinks past that? The dollar hasn't been around forever, but you expect it to be around forever in the future because it's been around your whole life. Who can guarantee that it won't be around in 15 years? Nobody can guarantee that. But most people just build their lives on this assumption that the dollar will be around forever. So they save in it. They do everything with the dollar. They account for everything. They plan for their future in the dollar. All of their entire life is basically just built around the dollar being around at some point in the future. And I think the Bitcoin Standard really got me to stop thinking that way. I think most most institutional investors, most people who are working in the finance industry, they just assume that the dollar will be around no matter what. And once you can get over that paradigm, once you can get over that just thought, when you have that paradigm shift that, okay, the dollar can collapse, I think it becomes obvious where things are going. As more people figure it out, I think more people will accumulate Bitcoin. That's just the conclusion that I came to after studying for a very long time. But most people aren't willing to put in that time. Most people aren't willing to even read the Bitcoin Standard. I've shared it with a lot of people, and they've said, no, I don't have time to read a 300-page book. But
yeah,
that's just how it is, right?
Yeah, it's too bad, because I think that should be the first reading that most people in TradFi go to is the Bitcoin Standard. And I kind of wonder, like most of the financial advisors I know, it seems like a bit of a cushy job, like just a financial advisor. I know there are much more stressful finance jobs, but you know, kind of work flexible hours. You're more or less, you know, index funds, very passive sort of investing strategies, and you're just taking calls on an as needed basis, it seems, a lot of times. And I wonder if, you know, there's that gives like a level of comfort and complacency to a lot of those folks. Like, why do I need to understand this Bitcoin thing? It's a lot easier to say it's speculative than to go spend 2,000 hours studying it. So I think you raised some really good points. I want to shift topics here. So this is something you've tweeted about a fair bit. You mentioned Michael Saylor, so MicroStrategy. So can you explain, like I'm a 5-year-old, and for anyone who hasn't, you know, really dug into the MicroStrategy playbook, what this sort of infinite money glitches that's been identified, mechanically, how does that sort of work, and what are they doing?
Yeah, of course. So I actually have a tweet on that here. I want to show you the tweet. I think the tweet just explains it really well. Okay, so this is the tweet. The premium right now for MicroStrategy shares is 2.7 times. So what's happening is MicroStrategy shares are being sold for more than the Bitcoin that they hold. So they're selling, they have a certain amount of Bitcoin. Their company is, this isn't the current value. I think it might have dropped right now. Maybe it's at 2.4, 2.5. But essentially what was happening is MicroStrategy was holding a certain amount of Bitcoin, and the value of that Bitcoin based on the market valuation was 2.7 times. So the market was valuing that Bitcoin at 2.7 times what the Bitcoin was worth. So if they have 252,000 Bitcoin, essentially the company was being valued at something like 600,000 Bitcoin. So what MicroStrategy was doing with this infinite money glitch that you were talking about before, they were issuing debt to buy Bitcoin. So they were issuing convertible notes where whoever was giving them money, they could essentially convert those convertible notes, the note that they have, into a certain amount of Bitcoin at a certain price. So when MicroStrategy hits a certain price, I think this was by 2028 that they can do it. It's almost like a call option where if the price is above a certain level, you can convert your note into a certain number of shares. So by 2028, each one of these notes can be converted into, let's say, 5 Bitcoin. But what MicroStrategy was doing is instead of using that money to run its operations, it was using it to buy Bitcoin. And that kind of spiraled into MicroStrategy buying more and more and more Bitcoin. And then eventually the market started valuing their company, the shares, at a lot more than what they were supposed to be worth. So we can see here, MicroStrategy can now issue new shares at this 2.7 times price. So every time MicroStrategy issues new shares, investors buy those shares and give MicroStrategy 2.7 times the value that they're getting in return. So they're giving them 2.7 Bitcoin worth of cash, essentially. The buyers are giving them 2.7 Bitcoin worth of cash. MicroStrategy gives out 1 Bitcoin worth of shares, and then MicroStrategy buys 2.7 Bitcoin. So it's that simple. It's not that much more difficult than this. MicroStrategy holders receive a Bitcoin yield because over time their shares are backed by more Bitcoin, because of course MicroStrategy is buying more Bitcoin and it's giving out an amount of shares that's worth only 1 Bitcoin. So it's buying 2.7, giving out only 1. So it's basically like they have those scams where if you give us $100, we'll give you $200 back. They're doing that, but they're doing it in real life and they're doing it for themselves. So they're getting it's almost like this person is giving them a certain amount of money, but then they can pad their numbers. They can pad their numbers and they can add more assets than the amount of cash that they're giving out. And the market has somehow allowed them to keep doing this. So over time, each share will represent more Bitcoin as long as MicroStrategy can continue doing this. Shares can be printed at will as MicroStrategy can find buyers. So as long as MicroStrategy can find buyers on the market, they can print more shares and they can sell them on the market. They can keep doing this.
Got it. That's a really good, simple way of breaking it down. So a dumb question for you from a non-financial guy: is the reason that that MicroStrategy was trading at a 2.7 or whatever the premium is today relative to its Bitcoin holdings, is that because it's a cash flow positive business that has, you know, actual operations? Is it because of the Bitcoin treasury? Is it because of a combination of various things? Like, why is it that they're trading at that premium? And then I guess the second question is there any world where they might be trading at a discount to the price of Bitcoin?
Yeah, so there is. I'll show you both right now. I'm going to switch over to another screen. There's this great tracker that I found. But over time, we can see here Bitcoin per share. This is what MicroStrategy is working on. So MicroStrategy is continuously increasing the number of Bitcoin that backs each share. So if they have, let's say, 1 billion shares or however many shares they have, each share is going to be represented by more and more Satoshis. So if you wanted to exchange your shares for Satoshis at some point in the future, you'll be able to get more Satoshis per share. And that's exactly what they're doing. So we can see here Bitcoin per share. Great website, by the way, mstr-tracker.com. So you can see here the BTC per share chart represents the amount of Bitcoin that each outstanding share of MicroStrategy equates to, providing insight into the exposure per share on the Bitcoin's on the company's stock. So we can see here it went from 0 Bitcoin per share to 0.004 Bitcoin per share, 0.0004 Bitcoin per share, to now 0.001 Bitcoin per share. And it keeps going. So what the market is expecting, in my opinion, is number one, that MicroStrategy's price will keep going up. And they think that because of this, the Bitcoin price will keep going up. So eventually they think that whatever they're paying right now for their MicroStrategy shares with that multiple, they'll probably get back that plus more because each share will represent more Bitcoin, plus Bitcoin's price will go up. So they have two things that could happen for them to actually make their money back. And yes, over time, the NAV premium, the net asset value premium could drop. The multiple could drop to below 1. So at one point in May of 2022, May 11th, 2022, the NAV premium was actually at 0.46. So people were willing to pay 46 cents on the dollar for every dollar of Bitcoin that that MicroStrategy held. And the only reason why this happens is because of market just fluctuations. People are selling and buying based on greed, based on emotions. They're selling because they think the stock is going to go to zero, for example. They think it's going to go bankrupt. So they're willing to give away their shares at 46 cents on the dollar for every Bitcoin that MicroStrategy has. But sometimes what I think is going to happen is this price is going to probably just blow out completely, and it's going to go absolutely nuts, because MicroStrategy is one of the easier ways for companies to get Bitcoin on their treasury, I guess. And then I also think that because of this, mm-hmm. the risk-adjusted return for MicroStrategy is much lower than the ETFs. Because again, with the ETFs, you don't get the full benefits of Bitcoin, but then you also don't have this happening in the background. So each share doesn't represent more Bitcoin over time. In the case of MicroStrategy, each share represents more Bitcoin over time. So we don't know what the ceiling of that is. We don't know how high this will go. For all we know, it could go to 0.02 Bitcoin, 0.03 Bitcoin. And as MicroStrategy keeps doing this, as they keep going, I don't think it'll go that high, of course. I'm being realistic here. I think it'll probably go to like 0.002 Bitcoin at some point. But it'll get more and more difficult for MicroStrategy to keep doing this over time. And I think that's what will probably bring this premium all the way down. I don't think it has anything to do with the profits of the company, to be honest. But maybe, who knows, maybe in the future, MicroStrategy will do more Bitcoin-related activities, and maybe they'll have a business built with Bitcoin in mind. So we don't know what's going to happen.
So like a company that, you know, like, you know, hits stride with AI or something right now, they might have the ability to do that further into the future, because their cash flow's better. People see that this is more promise, but like Michael Saylor, he's taken advantage of being the first mover on this. He can do this until he can't any longer, because no one else is really going about this at the moment. Is that a piece of it?
Yeah, no, definitely. So one thing that I wanted to point out here is that MicroStrategy has 252,000 Bitcoin. So they have about 1.2% of the total supply, something along those lines. I don't know what the exact numbers are there, but might be a little bit higher, a little bit lower. But I don't think any other publicly traded company is ever going to get to that point. I don't think any other publicly traded company or even country at this point is going to get to 252,000 Bitcoin, because the price is determined at the margin. If you want to buy Bitcoin, if you want to buy 252,000 Bitcoin, you're probably going to be paying a lot more than whatever MicroStrategy paid. MicroStrategy, keep in mind, did this over years. They did this over 4 years, I think, at this point. And they just keep accumulating. They don't worry about the price. They don't, that's exactly what it is. It's just keep stacking, keep buying. And eventually, no matter how late you feel like you are, I think if you have the conviction, if you really understand this, you're probably going to be doing pretty well. And I think MicroStrategy is at that point where they have this monopoly where nobody else is going to be able to reach them, though.
Yeah, it's wild. So hey, you talked too about MicroStrategy, and you distinguished MicroStrategy is investing, or MSTR is investing, versus Bitcoin BTC is savings. I think this is still a point that probably confuses a lot of people. Could you talk about what you mean by that and maybe expand on that thought a bit?
Yeah, of course. So when you save in something, you're expecting it you're expecting it to not be too volatile in terms of whatever you're saving. So let's say you save a bar of gold. You're expecting that gold to be there. You're expecting 1 ounce of gold to be equivalent to 1 ounce of gold over time, because you save in gold because you know that the supply of gold won't increase too much. You expect that in terms of dollars, it'll be volatile, but let's say 20 years down the line, you'll still have an ounce of gold. On the other hand, with, let's say, dollars, you don't know how many dollars will be produced. Dollars can be created at will. You can literally press, the Federal Reserve can literally press a number and create more dollars. On Bitcoin, it's a little different. On Bitcoin, you can save in Bitcoin. The value in terms of US dollars will continue to go up and down. But let's say 20 years down the line, if you own one Bitcoin, you'll still own one Bitcoin, one out of 21 million. No matter what happens, nobody can change that denominator. And that's the key here. So with Bitcoin, because the denominator stays the same, when you're saving in Bitcoin, you know what you'll have in the future. You'll still have this 1 out of 21 million. On the other hand, with dollars, if you save in dollars, you don't know what the denominator will be. But let's say right now it's 20 trillion. In 20 years, it may be 100 trillion, maybe 500 trillion. You have 1 out of 500 trillion. Essentially, what you're doing is your allocation of value in that economy is decreasing over time. The percentage that you have is decreasing over time. In terms of Bitcoin, it's not decreasing. So the way that I see Bitcoin is saving. So one Bitcoin equals to one Bitcoin, no matter what. If you have one Bitcoin, you can rest assured that in 6 months, a year, 10 years, 15 years, you'll have that Bitcoin. As long as you take care of your private keys, as long as you don't lose your Bitcoin, as long as nothing happens to, let's say, your wallet, if you don't mess it up, if you don't forget your PIN, all that stuff, if you have access to that one Bitcoin, you'll have access to one Bitcoin, regardless of what happens. On the other hand, with MicroStrategy, it's possible that MicroStrategy can go to zero. It's possible that MicroStrategy can be worthless. MicroStrategy shares are basically built on trust. They're built on the fact that you assume that MicroStrategy will hold onto your Bitcoin. They won't mess it up. They won't do something wrong. But if MicroStrategy messes up, you have counterparty risk, where if MicroStrategy messes it up, you take that loss. So when you buy MicroStrategy shares, they can go to zero. They can be worthless tomorrow for all we know. I don't think they will. But the reason why I buy MicroStrategy shares, I have MicroStrategy shares in a locked-in account. So the reason why I buy them is because I think over time, each share will represent more Bitcoin, because MicroStrategy is using this infinite money glitch to accumulate more and more Bitcoin. But I'm taking the chance that maybe MicroStrategy goes to zero. So I have this, in this case, we have this opportunity where you could end up with, let's say, you could end up outperforming Bitcoin by 10,000%. I don't think that'll happen, but just as a number, just to make sure that this gets across clearly. You could outperform Bitcoin by 10,000%. And let's say you could only afford one Bitcoin today. In 10 years, you may be able to buy 100 Bitcoin. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm not saying that's going to happen. But let's say 10 years from now, you could buy 100 Bitcoin with that one Bitcoin worth of MicroStrategy shares. It's also possible that in 10 years, you could end up with zero. So depending on whether or not you expect the value to go up or to stay the same, I know a lot of people who are buying MicroStrategy shares specifically because they want to be able to buy more Bitcoin in the future. They're taking the risk of not being able to buy any Bitcoin in the future. That risk is what leads to that reward, though. So you could end up with being able to buy 10 Bitcoin in the future. You could end up being able to buy 5 Bitcoin in the future instead of just one. But over time, MicroStrategy has this, I guess, strategy where they're increasing your Bitcoin holdings. They're giving you a Bitcoin yield. Again, it's risky. That's why it's an investment. On the other hand, Bitcoin is not it's not risky. If you have Bitcoin, you have Bitcoin. It's very likely that nobody will be able to shut down the network. There's no counterparty risk, so you don't have to rely on somebody else to hold your Bitcoin for you if you take it in self-custody. So Bitcoin is saving. MicroStrategy is investing. MicroStrategy is a company that you're expecting somebody else to work on your behalf to generate more Bitcoin. On the other hand, with Bitcoin, you're just holding on to that asset and you're not doing anything with it. It's just sitting in your account and you're good to keep it for however long you want to. I don't know if did that make the point clear?
Yeah, no, I think very clearly. And I think you're really hitting on an important point here that, you know, we see like record low savings rates right now. And anyone who's invested is effectively gambling on companies that they don't know anything about, they don't understand. And even their financial advisor doesn't, because no one's going through and reading, you know, all of the 10Ks, and there's just no way. And so I think what Bitcoin represents is like this optionality to just regain the, you know, this old notion of saving, of having something that's going to, at the very least, not lose value. But when you compare it to the potentially infinite supply of US dollars, it's going to absolutely accumulate in value, practically speaking. So I love that. And I want to So we're talking about investing. You hit on real estate earlier. I kind of want to come back to this because you talk about specifically Bitcoin demonetizing real estate. And I wonder if you could just explain what you mean by that and maybe like the timeline over which you see that happening, because there are a lot of people who own a second, third, fifth home that they're renting out to someone. And I'm sort of curious, like, when do some of those people start to wake up to the fact that I'm doing what they're doing with no jurisdictional risk, with no late night plumbing problems, with, you know, all of the, you know, none of the taxes and the challenges that you face owning real estate. So I'm curious, sort of to just hear an expansion of your position there.
Yeah, for sure. So what I mean by monetizing real estate is that real estate is being used as a savings vehicle today. So people are using real estate to save for the future because they expect that real estate values will rise faster than their purchasing power in terms of dollars. So dollars can be created at will. It's all just based on supply and demand. Very, very simple economics concept, supply and demand. If supply rises, but demand stays the same, price will come down. That's exactly what's happening with dollars. So every time dollars are being printed and added to the economy, what's happening is the demand is being fulfilled and the price can't go up. The purchasing power can't go up because as more dollars are entering the economy, the demand for those dollars is being fulfilled and people aren't bidding up for dollars. They don't want to get rid of anything to accumulate dollars. That's the main problem with dollars, because dollars can be printed at will. The value is always decreasing. On the other hand, with something like real estate, it takes time. It takes effort to build houses, to build buildings. You have to maintain your property. It takes more effort to own real estate, to hold real estate, to build real estate, to create more houses than it does to create more dollars. Dollars can be created at will, essentially. So what people are doing now is they're giving away their dollars because they have so many dollars. They're trying to give them away and they're trying to accumulate stocks, real estate, houses, single family homes, and they're using those to generate cash flow. So with housing, what they're doing is they're buying as many houses as they can. I actually know, I don't know if you know Grant Cardone. I think he owns something like 1,000 doors. That's what people call it, their rentals, like the units that they have. So he owns something like 1,000 units, which is absolutely nuts. I think that's crazy. But the way that people see it is housing is just a way to generate cash flow because people are going to need houses no matter what. They're going to need housing to as shelter. They're going to need housing. Other than if they don't have housing, then they're going to go homeless, and that's the main thing. So that's the assumption that a lot of real estate investors are making. But real estate investors haven't thought of the fact that houses can be created at will. On a US dollar standard, creating more housing is more difficult than creating more dollars. But on a Bitcoin standard, creating more houses is much more difficult, much easier than creating more Bitcoin. So creating more Bitcoin takes more time, energy, and effort over time, while creating more houses takes less time, energy, and effort over time. We get better at building houses over time. So when real estate investors think that my house is valuable because of the utility, location, 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 all that stuff, I don't think somebody who's homeless really cares. If you can't afford to pay your rent, if you don't have roots in a specific area, you probably don't care about that area. You probably don't care to buy a condo down. Like for me, for example, I don't care to buy a condo downtown Toronto. I know people want to, but what happens if people are suddenly okay with moving outside of that location that you bought in because of the price? What happens if developers start building higher? What happens if they start building? I read this on a tweet from someone. Somebody was just saying this. What if they start building underground and we basically create unlimited real estate? And now your property is one out. So right now your property is one out of a million or one out of 100,000 or one out of 10,000. But eventually, what if your property is one out of 20,000, one out of 50,000, one out of 100,000, one out of 10 million? And that denominator just keeps growing and growing and growing. And the supply of housing just rises so much that suddenly people don't need your house that much. The supply of houses has risen so much that demand has been fulfilled And now nobody's willing to pay you the rent that you need to keep your payments up to date, to service your debt. Now you're in trouble. Now, as a real estate investor, you have to sell your property because you can no longer manage to maintain it. You can no longer manage to pay for it. You have to get rid of your property. And let's say you have five properties and you have to sell every single one. What happens to the market price? The market price starts coming down. And keep in mind that a lot of people aren't going to figure this out until it's too late. A lot of people aren't going to figure it out until property values have dropped 50, 60, 70%. And just like with Bitcoin, as the price comes down, it drops even further because of fear, because of greed. People are worried that it's going to go to zero. I think what's going to happen with real estate is it's going to be absolutely insane. People are going to be willing to get rid of their properties for any amount of Bitcoin. That's why I think that the price of real estate in terms of Bitcoin will continue to decrease forever. In terms of dollars, it can increase forever. It can keep going up, right? A house that costs $1 million today can cost $100 million in 20, 30 years because you don't know how many dollars will be chasing that house. On the other hand, we know for a fact that the amount of Bitcoin chasing every single house is going to decrease. And because of that, people will have no reason to buy real estate. They'll have no reason to own real estate. Like you said, you're doing all the stuff that real estate is supposed to be promising, and you're doing it with 99% less headache. You don't have to maintain the property. You don't have to pay property taxes. You don't have to pay a land transfer tax. You don't have to be stuck in a certain area. Your government can't confiscate your property. If, let's say, for example, if you have your private keys stored in multiple locations, one of your areas gets bombed or you can't access that area, you just move to another private key. With Bitcoin, you can do that. With real estate, you can't. With real estate, let's say your area is under attack, you can't leave with your real estate. Your wealth is gone. If you have a ton of real estate in, let's say people who saved in real estate in Gaza and saved in real estate in, just, I'm not even making this political. I'm saying anywhere, even people in Israel. Israel is getting bombed. What other areas? All these areas are getting bombed in Ukraine, Russia. All the people who had real estate savings there, they're gone. And they're never going to get those savings back because that house is gone. They can't reclaim that house. You can't just build up a house out of thin air. It costs money and time and effort to build another house. So your wealth is gone. So these people are probably going to see the benefit of holding Bitcoin. And over time, the way that I see it, over time, more and more people will want to accumulate Bitcoin. Fewer and fewer people want to accumulate stocks and real estate. Fewer and fewer people will think of real estate as a savings vehicle. And eventually, over time, that's where demonetization happens. Because nobody's willing to pay rent to buy a house when they can just buy it, when they can just buy a 3D printed house or a trailer home or something that gives them shelter, and they no longer have to pay for this massive property, this massive amount of property taxes, this massive rent on this house that they can just get for much cheaper somewhere else.
You just hit on several risks to real estate that I think probably a lot of real estate owners don't even recognize, like some of the obvious jurisdictional but you know, yeah, what if you're one of a million doors at the moment, and in a couple of years you're one of 5 million doors, right? Like the value's been diluted, even if the nominal, you know, dollar denominated value looks better. Your purchasing power is, you know, decreased immensely on anything that you're earning. The other thing that I think you said that's really interesting, I've never thought of it this way, but the reason people, and I can assure you that most real estate investors haven't come to terms with this, the reason they've monetized real estate is because it's a heck of a lot harder to build a house than it is to print more dollars. I think I can't imagine 1% of real estate investors has ever thought about that. I think if they did, though, that would be a really, really good segue into why Bitcoin instead of real estate, because to your point, it's still infinitely harder to create more Bitcoin. At some point, it becomes impossible to create more Bitcoin than a house. And as technology gets better, more homes are easier and easier to create. So it's such an interesting and fascinating concept. But I'll be, what do you think the timeline is on this? Like, when does the real estate market get crazy because people are willing to sell their house at, you know, any price just to accumulate some Bitcoin? Do you think that's like an imminent thing here in the next couple of years, or do you think it's going to take a longer longer time for that to become, you know, fully appreciated?
I think it'll probably take some time. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. If you really look around, 99% of people have no idea what Bitcoin is. Like, if you bring it up to them, they're gonna be like, oh, that scam thing, why would you even want that? Most people have no idea what it is. Most people don't care. Real estate is so deeply ingrained in society right now that I don't think it's going to happen for at least 20 to 30 years. I think what's going to happen is, if real estate collapses, so will the dollar. I think that's the final outcome, I guess, but I don't think that's going to happen for a while. The reason why I say that is because all these banks are using real estate as collateral for all these loans that they gave out, and those loans are the main source of profit. If they can't make a profit, they can't really run a bank. The entire financial system collapses, and then at that point, the dollar loses all trust. I mean, again, this is so abstract. I don't think most people have even considered something like this, let alone considered actually happening in their real life. So I think it's going to take some time, but I mean, who knows? It could, if institutional investors start dumping their single family homes, their real estate properties, their residential real estate, it could happen a lot sooner than we all think.
That's a good point. Yeah, if BlackRock suddenly starts selling all its single family homes and kills the price in the market, people might get underwater and be forced out. But I still think today the problem is that there's still a knowledge gap. Even if people are forced out, they don't know what they're getting into. You know, like, they don't know that Bitcoin's the life raft in that situation, I don't think. But interesting point. All right. So I had an interesting podcast recording a week or two ago. And one of the guests, so I always ask at the end of the show, I ask for an unpopular opinion. And you get bonus points if it's unpopular amongst Bitcoiners. And I'll get to that question for you in just a bit. But his unpopular opinion was that effectively he believes hyper-Bitcoinization is a pipe dream, and that the powers that be are not going to go down. They're going to find ways to perpetuate sort of our current monetary paradigm, and that Bitcoin, and this guy's, he's a hardcore Bitcoiner, but he thinks Bitcoin is going to be more specifically like a form of freedom money used by people who want, you know, better privacy, autonomy, you know, ability to move and navigate where they want to go. Based on a couple of your answers, I have a suspicion as to your answer to this question, but my question is, do you believe in hyper-Bitcoinization, and how would you define that if so?
Oh yeah, I definitely believe in hyper-Bitcoinization. I think that the way I see it, most people probably won't want to accept dollars or pieces of paper for the value that they create, but that's going to take some time, of course. I think eventually, when people really see what Bitcoin is, when they really see that this current financial system is just an illusion, why would they want to continue earning pieces of paper? Again, there is a knowledge gap there, though. Probably going to take a lot of time, probably going to take a lot of effort from Bitcoin educators. But I think that that's what makes the job that we're doing, the work that we're doing, so valuable, because 99% of people have no idea what this is. And then by the time those 99% of people figure it out, I think hyper Bitcoinization will happen earlier than the 99% of people figuring it out. I think it'll happen. It'll start around, I'd say maybe like 5 to 10% of people figuring it out. I think it'll start mainly when merchants start accepting Bitcoin and nothing else for their goods and services. I think that will eventually happen, because I think maybe I'm being a little bit of an optimist here, but I think hyper Bitcoinization is the only way to get rid of the massive wealth gap that we have today. Right now, with the current financial system, people can delay gratification and they can get instant gratification at the same time. What I mean by this is that they can invest to save for the future, and then they can consume by borrowing against the assets they invested to get their instant gratification. So let's say you wanted to get a car and you have a massive mansion that has $500,000 of equity. What you can do is, instead of selling the mansion, instead of having to think about the opportunity costs, you can just borrow against the mansion and you can buy this car. But at some point, the way that I see it, why would the car producer want to continue accumulating dollars? Because they know that dollars can be created out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, maybe this is, again, maybe this is too abstract. Maybe most people will never get to this point. I mean, that maybe that's what the other person was thinking about. Maybe that's why hyper-Bitcoinization will never happen. But I mean, I personally think, I think I'm an optimist. I think that'll eventually happen. I think that's the only way to really solve the wealth gap that we have today. That's the only way to get people to start selling their houses when they want to consume, instead of being able to buy a house and then using that house, the equity in that house, using the inflation that increases the value of the house to keep consuming forever. People would actually have to sell their houses, meaning that housing will be redistributed. People will be able to buy houses. I think that ties in with what we were talking about before with real estate. When people have to consume and they have to use Bitcoin to consume, to spend their Bitcoin, they're no longer able to borrow fiat. Because the way that I see it, banks won't lend you fiat. They won't lend you Bitcoin. It'll be too risky. So I mean, I think it all ties in together, but who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it doesn't happen.
No, that's an interesting take. And I hadn't thought about the delayed gratification, instant gratification sort of paradigm where you can have, you know, you can have your cake and eat it too. It'll be interesting if you are right about hyper-Bitcoinization, it'll be interesting to see how some of those things change. Like the incentives, because you're right, banks are going to, if they start operating on a Bitcoin standard, they're going to be much more cautious about lending Bitcoin versus dollars, because they're fine if they don't get their dollars back relative to not getting their Bitcoin back. So that's you're giving me a lot to think about. I'm gonna have to go back and listen to this afterwards and like sit and ponder some of what you just said. But I think I'm with you on hyper Bitcoinization, and I think everyone defines it a bit differently. But the way I sort of view it is when we reach a point where the world is materially on a Bitcoin standard, not 100%, and it might not even take, 50 or 80% adoption. But I think to your point where it can be used as a medium of exchange, I think in a best case scenario, though, we start denominating goods and services in Bitcoin. I think that's going to take longer, though, because I anticipate volatility for some time to come. And you need to have a more steady measuring stick, I think, to think about like how do you price something that by today's standards can buy you more goods one day and less goods the next day, and
But again, that volatility is only because of the U.S. dollar. It's because we all trust the U.S. dollar. Eventually, that trust will go away. Eventually, the way that I see it, at some point, a Bitcoin will be worth so many dollars that. Okay, so it's like I went to Argentina not too long ago. I went to Argentina maybe about a month ago. And in Argentina, it's not like they were thinking that prices won't be determined in US dollars because the US dollar is too volatile in terms of Argentinian pesos. I think that's the comparison that I see it from. With Bitcoin isn't volatile on its own. One Bitcoin, like one Bitcoin is worth one Bitcoin, right? It's the dollar that's volatile. It's the lens of the dollar that makes us think that Bitcoin is volatile. Once the world gets out of that perspective, I think only a small number of people need to do that. Only a small number of people need to figure that out to realize that maybe Bitcoin isn't volatile. Maybe Bitcoin is the least volatile thing that we have, because it's the only thing that we know how much supply there will be. Nothing. We don't know anything. We don't know the supply and demand for anything else.
Yeah, I guess I agree with everything you just said. I guess the way I'm thinking of it is like the order of operations in which, like, do people lose faith in the dollar soon enough that Bitcoin's purchasing power, not its value, one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin, but its purchasing power is sort of stabilized, so to speak. I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to express exactly what's in my head. But I understand what you're saying, that, if Bitcoin's price, goes through the roof because of global liquidity increases, Bitcoin didn't really change. There's more money in the system, and it's, at the same time, from day to day, the dollar's value doesn't change. Like today and tomorrow, the dollar's value is going to be approximately the same, right? I can buy the same, but Bitcoin's price could drop 10% relative to the dollar. The value of Bitcoin could drop 10% in that same day. And I understand that that's human volatility more than it's Bitcoin's volatility, so to speak. Yeah. But the implications are the same, is that I can buy less if Bitcoin's price drops 10% in a day than I can with the same amount of dollars that I had yesterday. Somehow that needs to start getting worked out, I guess, I think, for hyper Bitcoinization.
Yeah. And I think that's going to take some time. You're completely right. You're completely right about the purchasing power. I was thinking of it differently, but you're right on that, because right now, why would somebody want to give away their Bitcoin when they know that it'll increase by 50% in purchasing power over the next 20, 30 years, or however long? I don't know how long it'll be. Maybe it'll go up 1,000% in the next few years, and then it'll slow down a little bit. Who knows how the trajectory will happen? Who knows what the chart will look like? But I get what you're saying. Why would somebody want to give away their Bitcoin when they know that their Bitcoin is going to increase in purchasing power over time? But what I think will happen is people will just stop spending money on things that they don't need. I think they'll not need, but they'll stop spending money on just useless crap, essentially. So let's say you have to spend money on food. Regardless of what happens to Bitcoin, you're going to buy food. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what happens to Bitcoin, you're going to have to pay for gas. You're going to have to pay for shelter. I think what people will do is they'll focus more of their savings on buying the things that they need, and maybe they'll cut out on the things that they want. So maybe they'll cut out on, if you have 5 streaming services, maybe you'll cut down to 1 and you'll get rid of 4 of them and you'll put all that money into Bitcoin. But I think people are already actually doing that. The Bitcoiners are already doing that. But I do also think that people will want to spend money on, let's say, vacations, spending time with their family and friends. And I don't think the appreciation matters in that case.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. It's such a hard conversation to have, because we are using such a horrible measuring stick. Like, even in talking about purchasing power, like how much car or how much house can you get for your Bitcoin? You're still sort of doing this intermediary calculation to dollars or whatever your local fiat currency is, because that's the benchmark we've been using for so long. And that is over any, long time horizon, not necessarily just fluctuating, but the parity's increasing between what a Bitcoin is worth and what a dollar is worth. So it's such a challenging conversation to have. Let me take one quick step back, because I think I just have a couple more questions for you. But when you were talking about, and again, we don't dive a lot into price predictions, but you did throw out some numbers early on. Are you talking generally when you're talking about, I think Bitcoin could be worth $1 million or whatever, are you referring in today's purchasing power or in that future date purchasing power?
Well, I think the nominal value is going to increase forever.
Yeah.
Right. The value that you're getting your Bitcoin at, like, let's say in terms of dollars, it's going to increase forever. The real purchasing power will also, I personally think the real purchasing power will increase forever. And I think the $1 million that I was referring to back then, I don't remember what the context of it was, but eventually Bitcoin's purchasing power will be $1 million in today's money.
Mm. Okay.
One Bitcoin will be worth that. Who knows what the nominal value will be at that point? Maybe the nominal value will be 20 million.
Yeah. That's kind of what I'm expecting too, because who knows what the next crisis is, and World War III seems to be, at our doorstep every day. So, but they'll have a reason to print soon enough. And the contractions and these issues seem to be getting closer and closer together. So it's been 4 years since, COVID. I can't imagine what's next. So one last sort of broad question, and I want to round it out with your unpopular opinion, but we've sort of talked about the trajectory of Bitcoin a lot. I'm curious, like, the order in which you see dominoes fall in, because when El Salvador announced, Bitcoin is legal tender, there were a lot of people who were like, oh, who's the next, the next country to adopt Bitcoin, and been pretty quiet for a few years. Right. And, the ETFs were approved. We have, I think, one pension fund in the US has indicated they've taken on a little bit of a Bitcoin allocation in one of the ETFs or a couple of the ETFs. We still just have MicroStrategy. Like, who do you anticipate, which of those sort of groups, nation states, corporates, like bigger Wall Street types, retail investors, who do you think is going to pick up steam on the Bitcoin adoption front first? And then how do you anticipate the dominoes falling from there?
I think retail will be last. Retail investors who don't figure it out will probably be working for Bitcoin in the next 20, 30 years, however long it takes for hyper Bitcoinization to happen. I mean, we're technically all already working for Bitcoin. We're all we're creating value right now. We're recording this podcast. We're giving things up to accumulate. I mean, at the end of it, if you get paid for this podcast, if my end is monetized, we get paid in Bitcoin, right? That's what we're doing. We're accumulating Bitcoin. But I think what's going to happen is the institutional investors will probably be, so the people who are in it now are front running most institutional investors. So we're the early adopters, in my opinion. The institutional investors will probably be the early majority. I think they'll be with the early majority. I think the people who have done really well with stocks and real estate will probably be some of the last, because it's like I said, it's a paradigm shift. If real estate is doing really well for you, why would you look at something else? Why would you research something else unless you're hurt by its adoption? And that's not going to happen for a while. Most real estate investors still see their property values going up. They still see the cash flow coming in terms of rental income. But I mean, at some point, if real estate property values start coming down and they can no longer pay for their mortgage with the rental income that they're getting, that could be a problem. And so the way that I see it, it'll probably be just the early majority, the early adopters. I think that's where we are right now. ETFs, of course, have made it widely available for everybody. Most people still don't care, though. It's not like just because the ETFs are available now, everybody's going to start buying. That's not how it works. Right now, most people are still ignoring it. I think what happens next is, so I think this actually ties in with my my unpopular opinion, I guess you can say. Most people are going to ignore Bitcoin until it reaches $1 million, $10 million. Until it reaches those levels, most people are going to keep ignoring it because it's too hard to wrap your head around. It takes 3 to 4 years to really understand it. You have to go through a cycle or two, and maybe those cycles don't come anymore. Maybe the price just goes up steadily. Maybe it just keeps increasing. And maybe that's the most painful way to adopt Bitcoin, because I was looking at the trends. I was looking at Google Trends. And when the price drops, a lot of people Google Bitcoin. And then when the price spikes, a lot of people Google Bitcoin. They search for Bitcoin. So what that means is that when the price drops, people are looking at Bitcoin. They're noticing what it is. But if the price just moves sideways, or if it just steadily increases, people don't look at Bitcoin. They don't care, because they aren't hurt
boring.
By it.
Yeah, right? It's like boring. The number go up, allure dissipates.
That's exactly what it is. So it's boring. So people don't look at it. They don't care. So I think what's going to happen is, if that happens, let's say if institutional investors are smart and they just keep accumulating over time, goes to $100,000, then it slowly creeps up to $1 million. Most retail investors are just going to be left out, right? And I think more countries are going to adopt it. I mean, for all we know, let's say China goes and dumps all their US treasuries for Bitcoin. That could happen, right? Who's going to stop that from happening? Nobody can stop that from happening. But then if that happens and they buy all of the Bitcoin available on every single exchange around the world, what does Bitcoin's price go to? I think that's that's the most painful thing that people are probably going to experience. I think the pain that comes from the market isn't, a lot of people think, Bitcoin going to zero is the most painful thing. No, it's not. It's not the most painful thing, because only 1% of people have adopted it. I think the most painful thing would be if Bitcoin goes to $1 million and most people are still on the sidelines. And now they have to, instead of being able to work 1 hour to get 30,000 Satoshis, they have to work an hour to get 300 Satoshis. That's the most painful thing that I think that's what the trajectory is going to be. I think I might have just completely gone away from the question that you asked, but I think over time that's how it's going to happen.
No, that you went down an interesting route though. That's a really interesting way of framing it. So, I mean, you started off answering the question, and I had a follow up to you. So you talked about like the, we're in the early adoption stage. We're moving into the early majority and then the late majority. Do you think that the timeline on those stages is going to be compressed relative to what, you know, we've been in the early, what's the first phase of the, you know, the innovation or the adoption life cycle called, like the, it's like, you know, I don't know what it is. Adopters.
Innovators,
I thought there was, the innovators. So like the innovators are like the Bitcoin OGs, probably the first couple of years. We're in early adopters, and it's taken us 15 years and probably not really out of the early adopter stage. Maybe we're getting closer. But do you think that the early majority and then the late majority, do you think that timeline is going to be compressed into like a 5-year period or something? Because the institutional investors who I think you are hypothesizing come in as the early majority, are they going to sort of trigger a flood of later majority people in because that price action goes crazy or because people open their eyes and realize there's something to this? It's not a scam, or, you know, like, do you think a lot of this happens much more quickly than we've seen the last 15 years?
Yeah, I think because I was looking at some charts on the adoption of Bitcoin. The adoption of Bitcoin has been faster than the internet, which to me is just insane. Wild. And if you look at I don't know if you know about the technology adoption charts, the S curves.
Yeah.
It's insane because what happens is in the beginning we have that slowly and then we have suddenly. So we have slowly, it's the slow growth, people just telling their network, telling people about where this is going. And then suddenly everybody wants it. And that's because the people around them are telling them about it and the people around them are using it. So with cell phones, for example, if nobody owned a cell phone, what value would that cell phone be to you? You probably wouldn't have social media, probably wouldn't have people to call. I mean, you could call people at their houses, but most people aren't going to be texting. Most people aren't going to be using WhatsApp. But over time, as that base is built, I think we're building that base right now. That's what the innovators are. That's what the early majority is. I think we're in the early adopters. So the early adopters and the innovators are building that base and they're spreading this to everybody they know. It's like a virus, essentially. That's basically what it is. So over time, it's spreading to more and more people. More and more people eventually will adopt it. I don't know when that'll happen. Who knows? Maybe we're at the beginning of that vertical part right now. Yeah. But if that happens, the way that I think it'll go is if the price just skyrockets overnight, the adoption will happen much, much quicker. But if the prices goes sideways, it'll happen a lot slower. Of course, I guess they're tied in together. The price has to skyrocket because of more adoption. But if companies and institutions just start buying a ton of Bitcoin, price is going to skyrocket. It's going to get more people interested. So,
yeah. It'll be an interesting few years ahead of us regardless, I am. Yeah. Most certain. All right. See, you hinted at it, but unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if it's offensive to Bitcoiners.
If I want it to be offensive, I would probably say. I guess I have two. So if I want it to be offensive, I'd probably say, "Oh, Bitcoin's going to move sideways for the next 10 years," and I think that's entirely possible. I genuinely think that could happen because a lot of institutional investors still think Bitcoin is a joke. If there's enough sell pressure, if enough people are shorting Bitcoin, it could drop, right? But eventually, it's like that analogy where you can't hold a beach ball under the water for very long. Who knows if it could happen for the next 10 years? I don't know if anybody has the funding to do that for 10 years. For all we know, the U.S. government could start shorting Bitcoin and just borrowing as much money as they want to fill their margin, to pay for their margin and all that stuff. Maybe they start shorting it to keep the price suppressed. And then it suddenly skyrockets. But I also think that like the opposite side of it is, and in my opinion, the more painful thing would be if Bitcoin were to go to $1 million, let's say by the end of 2024. I think that's something that a lot of Bitcoiners haven't thought about. I don't think they've thought of the possibility of that because they think that eventually if Bitcoin goes to $100,000, people are going to sell their Bitcoin. And that's entirely possible. That's definitely possible. But I think what's going to happen is when Bitcoin goes to $100,000, more people are going to be triggered into studying Bitcoin. And what do you sell your Bitcoin for? Are you going to sell your Bitcoin for Apple stock? Are you going to sell it for the S&P 500? Are you going to sell it for... Why would you want to hold dollars if you hold Bitcoin in the first place? So the assumption that it'll take a long time for adoption to happen is based on the people who hold Bitcoin right now selling what they have. And I don't think most people have considered that maybe the people who hold Bitcoin right now won't sell what they have. Maybe they'll just hold on. And again, maybe this is not a contrarian opinion. Maybe this is something that everybody is thinking. Maybe this is an amateur investor opinion. But I don't know. I think it could go either way. I think the more painful idea for Bitcoiners would be that it goes sideways. The more painful idea for everybody else is that it goes to $1 million by like December, by January.
Again, an interesting way of framing it. Man, you've given me so much to think about. Thank you so much. I'll be interested to see if we get some feedback from people on your unpopular opinions, because I don't know if those are... I bet you we're going to have like a split sort of perspective on that, whether or not it's unpopular or not. But thank you so much for your time, man. This has been an absolute pleasure. You, as always, drop some gems into the conversation and have given me a lot to think about. So I really appreciate you coming on. Do you want to give a handoff and let everyone know where they can find you?
Yeah, for sure. I'm on YouTube. Just Rajat Soni Finance. If you just search for my name, Rajat Soni, and then even if you add Bitcoin at the end, you'll find it as well. I'm also on Twitter, as we mentioned before, regularly posting on Twitter. I'm trying to post as much as I can on YouTube just before things go crazy. Keep people's demand for content satisfied so I can get them to keep coming back to my channel. So check out my channel if you can, if you have the time. Other than that, you can book meetings with me if you want to. I have a link on every one of my videos if you want to do a one-on-one meeting. I also have a community if you want to join something like that. If you're interested, go for it. Again, the link is in my YouTube videos.
Yeah, we'll share it in the show notes as well. Rajat, thank you so much for your time, man. Really enjoyed it and look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Michael. I appreciate it.
Take care. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Make sure you follow Rajat on YouTube. Follow him on X. He's got some unbelievable content. If you're enjoying this show, do me a favor. Like, subscribe, share it with a friend, someone who you think might be interested. We'd really appreciate it. And of course, if you need help with proper 100% Bitcoin-only self-custody, online privacy phones, if you need help with a Plan B residency to citizenship option, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'd love to talk with you. You can also follow The Bitcoin Way on X. We're at @TheBitcoinWay_. You can follow me there as well @TheOtherMJordan. And as always, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.